Okay. 11-2750, Smith versus Union Pacific Railroad. Good morning. It's Mr. Thomas Eppy?
Thomas B. That was pretty close.
Yeah.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Amir Thomasby. I represent the appellant in this action. Your Honor, there's just 2 points that I want to make. The first goes to the Court's application of the discovery rule. I think you'll see the only basis for dismissal pursuant to the discovery rule were the allegations of the complaint. And what the Court did and what the defendant argued is that the mere allegation that the plaintiff was denied return to work in 2006 started the time frame in order for him to file his EEOC complaint within the 300 days.
But based on the complaint, isn't it clear that he should have discovered the injury in 2006, even if he wasn't aware that the injury was unlawful until later in time?
And I understand that distinction. The answer, Judge, is no, and here's why. Because this isn't a situation where there's a termination. It's not a situation where he's denied some benefit. He was working with Union Pacific under his collective bargaining contract, and they were telling him, we're going to let you back to work, we're going to let you back to work, continue with this program. When you successfully complete the program, you'll come back to work. Now, is the complaint clear on that point? I would agree it's not. And what the Court had to do in order to grant dismissal was take that allegation that he was denied return to work and make the jump, make the inference that Mr. Smith should have known there was an injury and should have filed an EEOC complaint.
I have a somewhat different question because I can understand conceptualizing this as at what moment did he satisfy Union Pacific's condition precedent to his actually being back on the job. But it seems that you think that the answer to this lies in the medical records, which Union Pacific, that the Rush people somehow put down, now he's done, you know, he's successfully. But why aren't the medical records equally accessible to him? They're his own medical records. He has a right to them.
Well, I think what you're asking at that point is for him to second-guess what he's being told by the Union Pacific
doctor. Well, yeah.
Doctor.
I mean, you know, if he's in a medical treatment program, wouldn't you think he'd want to look at his own medical records?
Well, he would have. I'm not saying that his medical records, in fact, in 2006 said he completed the program. I'm saying that there's a subsequent doctor that told him he believed the program was completed back in 2006. The
doctor. Where does that come from? You know, is that the treating agency's determination, or is that Union Pacific's evaluation of some discursive medical report, or what is it?
That's Union Pacific's
evaluation.
And Union Pacific telling him, we don't think you're ready to return. Which is an important distinction because I don't think Mr. Smith has a duty in 2006 to challenge what his employer is saying. At that point, he could risk termination. And I think that's another critical fact, that Union Pacific never terminated Mr. Smith and never indicated they would terminate him. However, if Mr. Smith goes to Union Pacific and says, hey, I don't believe you. I'm not going through any more of the program. Prove to me this is an issue. It's just not reasonable, I don't think, for Mr. Smith to do that, especially someone that voluntarily himself came forward and said, I want to get better. I want to continue working. So I don't think, based on the face of the complaint, and I'll grant you it could have been clear with respect to when he actually knew, based on the face of the complaint, you can't say, especially looking at it in a light most favorable to my client, that he knew or reasonably should have known of this injury in 2006.
Does the record contain specific overtures on Mr. Smith's part to the Union Pacific people saying, you know, I'd like to come back, am I ready yet, or, you know, anything like that, any requests to be reinstated to working status?
Well, there's just the complaint right now in his affidavit that's on the record, and he did submit to come back, and they continued to tell him, and this is all that's just in the complaint.
Okay,
and the
no, that's fine, but the complaint alleges that there are, you know, communication somehow, submission, some.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. He's not continuing to jump from one program to the other without asking them to come back, and the record is clear on that. So I do think that this is different from the Cata case, the Sharp case, and those cases where they had testimony, and you couldn't see it any other way than they reasonably should have known there was an injury. That's not the case here, and I don't think that one allegation or two allegations in the complaint are sufficient for dismissal just on that basis. And the second point I'd like to raise real briefly goes to the repleting. The court denied us any right to replete, and I think also that umbrella, under that umbrella, is the fraudulent concealment and potential issue with these medical records, which could presuppose a basis for tolling the statute of limitations. That's, of course, if the court's to find that the statute of limitations, the action accrued and he knew of the injury.
I want to just ask you, Sam, do the facts underlying your equitable estoppel claim appear in the complaint itself?
They do not, Your Honor.
So you're relying on facts asserted in the response brief for that?
That's correct, Judge. And we think we gave the court a basis in our response brief to at least allow us to replead those issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey. Hi, Ms. Farley.
May it please the Court, Tracy Farley, representing Defendant Appellee Union Pacific Railroad. I think it's important to note in this case that the complaint only states that Mr. Smith knew in 2006 that Union Pacific refused to return him to work.
Well, you know, it's true that he didn't assert facts in his complaint that would be sufficient to demonstrate timeliness, but hasn't he set forth sufficient facts in his response brief and briefing to this court to indicate a chronology that, if it was asserted in an amended complaint, might resolve the issue of timeliness?
No, Your Honor, he did not. In his affidavit, all he states is that he did not realize until 2010 that he had been injured by Union Pacific's actions.
So I think, I guess I'm thinking of this case in two ways. One of them is whether this case fits within, if you will, the exception that we recognize for treating a limitations period as an affirmative defense, such that it can actually be resolved on the pleadings as opposed to later on, or whether it really doesn't fit well within that. And another question I have is whether this is about his reinstatement or whether it's about the slightly different question, at what moment did he satisfy this almost qualification condition, this condition precedent to being reinstated? Because it's a little bit different from the reinstatement, and I think it entirely possible that Union Pacific might have its own standards for when it thinks somebody with an addiction problem of some sort has been cured. They might say to the health care provider, well, you think he's been okay for 6 months, but we have a one-year period or something. Anything. I don't think Union Pacific, in other words, is stuck with the lowest possible standard. They might have a higher standard. So I'm not sure that he would have any way of reading their minds as to what was the real moment when he had finally met the standard that they set forth.
To answer your first question, it was apparent from the face of the complaint that the statute of limitations applied. It was not until on response that plaintiff then raised the issues of fraudulent concealment and equitable estoppel. And I think that
well, and characterizing it, I mean, we want to be careful because there's a reason statute of limitations is an affirmative defense. It's because sometimes the moment when the claim accrues isn't clear. That, I think, is what we're discussing here. Sometimes it's because there's actually an exception, which is a somewhat different thing, like the fraudulent concealment or estoppel theories.
And I think that is an important distinction because plaintiff never raised the issue that any of the alleged denials to his reinstatement were adverse actions that were also subject to additional charges and therefore subject to additional 300-day periods. Even in his affidavit, he does not raise that issue. He does not raise the issue when or if Union Pacific ever denied his request for reinstatement. And ultimately, it's just based on one statement in the response brief in support of his arguments for fraudulent concealment and equitable estoppel, that where he states that Union Pacific had access to his medical records and thereafter denied his reinstatement.
But why shouldn't this at least have been, at this early stage of the case, if you're right, a dismissal without prejudice to allow him to see if he could clarify what I'm calling the accrual point, that the injury was really in Union Pacific's failure to let him know when it regarded him as qualified to return, or possibly the exception points, the estoppel points. I mean, maybe he could succeed, maybe he couldn't. But why at this very early stage not give him the chance?
I think the judge did give him that opportunity by considering his affidavit.
To replead?
Well, he gave him the opportunity in terms of considering the facts that he alleged in his affidavit and his response to see whether or not he could ultimately state a claim for fraudulent concealment or equitable estoppel. He gave him that opportunity, and it wasn't contained anywhere in the affidavit. And therefore, any additional motion to amend would arguably be futile at that point because he's already set forth his best case. And the judge considered that, and therefore dismissal with prejudice was appropriate.
But it's a pretty unusual finding, you know. Ordinarily, you know, the plaintiff's entitled to at least one opportunity to cure the problem by, you know, and then amending the pleadings.
And I think in this case, had the judge just considered the pleading itself under the 12b6 motion, dismissal without prejudice would have been proper. I think he cut to the chase and said, look, I'm going to consider the affidavit at this point because that's really what would have been presented on a motion to amend the complaint.
Do we know that, though? I mean, he has this affidavit, and maybe that was an assumption. I'm not sure we know that for sure.
Well, you would, on his response brief, you would think that he would put forth his best case in order to stave off any motion to dismiss. At that point, I think he rolled the dice. He had an option at any point during this proceeding to move to amend his complaint. He did not do so. He had the opportunity at any point to move to amend his affidavit if he thought it didn't include all the facts that he thought were important to the judge's decision in terms of fraudulent concealment and equitable estoppel. Now, I think the important point about both of these exceptions to the statute of limitations is that he has to show that Union Pacific took some active steps to conceal the fact that he was cured of his alcoholism and therefore prepared to return to work. I think, as you recognize, Judge Wood, that he was in the best position to determine when his cause of action accrued, when he himself felt that he was prepared to return to work. And at that point in time, he should have brought his charge of discrimination. That's not what the complaint says. But at any point, if there is going to be a time where he had the opportunity to do so, it was when he himself thought that he was prepared to return to work. If there aren't any other questions, I would respectfully request that the district court's decision be affirmed. Thank you
so much.
Young lawyer, it's always a pleasure to argue before you, but if you don't have any further questions, I don't have any more to add.
Oh, how lovely, a young lawyer. Two young lawyers. All right. Thank you so very much. The case is taken under advisement. This court will be...